This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA plus community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to another Joy 94.9 podcast.
The Carpenters on Saturday Magazine on Joy 94.9 on Top of the World. And on top of the world, we hope, looking on top of the world anyway, is Hayley Conway, who has recently retired as the co-convener of the Victorian Gay and Lesbian Rights Lobby. Welcome to Saturday Magazine, Hayley. Now I'll say you can say thanks again.
Thanks.
That's
thanks
better. Now I've turned you on.
We heard you, but they didn't.
We're just going to lovingly cut Hayley open and lay her out on the table and find out all about what's
That's
inside.
That's what Journey's all about.
Oh, and what makes you tick. Hayley, tell us a little bit about where you've come from and your family background and how you've kind of got to where you are today.
All right. Well, I'm actually from New South Wales, so I grew up in Western Sydney, which is probably about halfway between the Blue Mountains and Sydney City itself, in a place called Blacktown. I went to a private Christian school. That was good times. The same school all the way through kindergarten to year 12, and then moved around a bit, lived in London for a little while, lived in Wollongong where I first went to uni, and then lived in Sydney City and then ended up in Melbourne. So a little bit nomadic.
Okay, I've got my first question.
All right.
Christian school.
Yep.
Did you have any idea when you were growing up? Because you're not exactly ancient, I'm telling you, girls and boys.
Yeah.
Hayley's a young woman.
Retired was a misleading sort of
word. You look very young to retire.
Yeah, she's not nowhere near retiring age. Did you know when you were growing up that you were not necessarily of the standard mould, and how did that go at a Christian school?
Well, look, I definitely knew that I was not necessarily of the standard mould. I don't know that that had much to do with my sexual orientation or not. I was always a bit of a strange child, so. But when I was at school, I didn't really have much to do with relationships at all. I was a pretty busy, overachieving kind of kid.
Okay.
So I didn't really get involved with anybody, really.
So it wasn't an issue for you?
Didn't even think about it. Yeah.
Okay. And Sydney to Melbourne.
Mm.
How and why?
Well, why not?
Exactly. We love Melbourne.
I love Melbourne. Yeah. Mm. I had a job here with the National Union of Students, and this is where the headquarters is. So I moved halfway through my elected term with them to be based out of their head office, which is in Melbourne, and then decided that I liked it enough to stay. So that was pretty much it.
So it sounds like you've always had a bit of political passion there.
Oh, yeah?
Tell us about your political passion of your National Union of Students, Victorian Gay and Lesbian Rights Lobby. Mm-hmm. Where did that come from and what fuels that passion?
I think probably a little bit does have to do with the way that that I was raised. So it has a bit to do with, you know, the attending of a Christian school that had a pretty strong sort of social justice background, if not quite what I'm doing now.
Slight different direction.
Yeah, slightly. But, you know, same sort of ethic underpins it to an extent, you know, where you see those sorts of injustices occurring and you say, well, that's not good enough and I'm in a position where I can do something to help, whatever that may be, whether it's having conversations with people that you know all the way up to organising, you know, sort of active campaigns and legislative reform and things like that. So, that's pretty much it.
And were your parents passionate and political?
They're both pretty passionate people. My parents divorced when I was about two, I think, so mm-hmm. I sort of grew up with them always being separate but living in the same sort of neighbourhood. And my dad's a big lefty, you know, he grew up in East London, so, you know, really strong union background and those sorts of things, but also really strong, you know, sort of social justice ethics, I guess. And they're both teachers as well, so they've both been very strong unionists all the way sort of through, and that was just normal, I guess. And, you know, my mum's got some pretty strong views about things as well that she likes to convey, and we don't necessarily agree about things. The school was pretty much her choice, but that's okay.
I was wondering that, I suppose, because we don't necessarily, and again, it's a stereotype, it's an assumption that we make, but we don't assume divorced parents, strong left-wing unionist, Christian school. We kind of go, hang on, what's interesting about this combination?
Yes, there's so many things that are interesting about that combination.
Oh, we'd love to know more. And so that your mum has obviously got a Christian background and was keen, or was it about the belief, or was it about the type of school?
I guess the area that I was in was it was certainly pretty rough at the time, most, I think most kids ended up going to sort of private schools of various types. You know, there's loads and loads of independent, generally religious schools in the area that are not particularly of a high socioeconomic sort of background either, but they're just not the local public school.
Yep.
You know, which is a bit of a pity, but a reality. But also certainly my mum wanted me to go to a school where it did have a very strong Christian ethic in it, and that's why they chose the school that they did.
In an attempt to settle the locals on the straight and narrow, so to speak.
Yes, indeed. don't know how well that worked. I've got some pretty hilarious siblings as well. So, yeah, I'm not sure how happy she was in the end, but what can you do?
Okay, so big family?
There are four of us. My younger sister's living in London and sort of moves between gigs as a dancer and working in hospitality, I think, as most performing artists,
yes,
tend to.
Exactly.
And both of my older siblings, a brother and a sister, have kids and partners and those sorts of things. So, yeah, and we're all sort of spread all over the place. So,
and where do you fit in the foursome?
I am the second youngest.
Okay. How's that? You know, it's not quite the middle child, but it's somewhere in there. What was it like growing up with lots, not lots, but you know, there's more than a couple of you.
Look, I think some people would certainly say that I had a touch of middle child syndrome. I don't think that's true personally. I would say absolutely not true, and I'm a well-refined human being because of it. I think it was pretty interesting. We all get along a lot better now. My two sisters and I are incredibly close in age, so we're all sort of I think it's about 20 months between the three of us in total, so
wow,
pretty close together. Mm. And there were certainly lots of conflicts growing up, but as we've gotten older, we all get along a lot better. So that's pretty nice. And, yeah, but we're all very different people, I think, and the only thing that we all have in common is some sort of we all like a bit of physical activity, really, so that's about it, sport.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And your parents sporty?
My dad is, yep. Yeah, he still plays football, soccer, football.
Real football.
Yeah, that's right, real football. If you carry it in your hands, it's not actually football.
right.
Yes, yes. he still does that, and he's in his mid-50s now. And, so we all play a little bit of something if we can.
How do you think four children who are brought up roughly the same end up, you're saying you're all really different?
Yep.
Well, what's your take kind of on that? Why do you reckon that is, that you're all so different?
I think, you know, we had different friends, different influences, and we are different people. So I think, you know, even if you go to the same school, you get different things out of it depending on what matters to you. And that was probably it.
Yep. Fantastic. We are speaking with Hayley Conway, who's who was the co-convener. I'm not going to use the word retired now, Hayley, because you've put me right off that, who has recently been the co-convener of the Victorian Gay and Lesbian Rights Lobby. And Hayley's sharing her story with us, and we'll continue that very shortly. You're on Saturday Magazine on Joy 94.9.
Joy 94.9, made in Melbourne from local ingredients.
Joy 94.9, you're listening to Saturday Magazine with Mez and Marg. And joining us in the studio, we'll continue Hayley Conway's journey. She's former co-convener of the VGLRL.
We were talking about inspiration before all that.
Sure.
And I'm guessing what's inspired you to be involved in the Victorian Gay and Lesbian Rights Lobby.
Okay. What inspired me in the first place? I moved to Melbourne for a term, an elected term with the National Union of Students. And as that was wrapping up, I was looking for something, a similar organisation that I could be involved in terms of advocacy and policy and things like that. And they were the obvious choice. So, yeah, made a few phone calls, met up with a few people, and that was that, really.
Why were they the obvious choice?
I think because they have done so much and had such a good reputation for doing much of the advocacy, but also the campaigning and the work with people on the ground as well. And that was what was really important, is that they didn't just sort of go off and do all these high level conversations with ministers or in government, but actually spend a lot of time, appearing at community events and talking with different organisations and really trying to sort of, not just do what they thought was important, but to take the community along with them and to take direction from the community about what was important as well. So, that was why them.
And how long have you been involved with the VGLRL?
Since 2007, so about 3 years now.
Yep.
Yes.
And we have to say that even though you're no longer the co-convener, you're mm-hmm. still involved.
I am, yes. After I took a step back from being co-convener, I've stayed on the Committee of Management, which is essentially the Board of Government for the lobby. So have just stayed doing the various things that I can do without being a public face.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And we just want to explore for a minute that notion of stepping back from a role.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people get involved in community organisations and sometimes feel like they can never get out again.
Yeah.
And that can put people off. What made you go, you know, time for me to just take that step back?
Yep. Well, really it was that this is a federal and state election year, but a federal election, which is sort of where I guess my heart is at. I find state government to be just a little bit strange and just this extra layer of weirdness. So, but I do really enjoy a bit of federal politics. And so I've actually taken a job with the Australian Greens this year, mm-hmm. working on their federal election campaign for the Senate. So, yeah, that's what I'll be doing. And it seemed a bit remiss to sort of stay as a spokesperson for a lobby group while also working for a political party. And I think it's good to be honest about those things.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah.
So what are the things you've been involved with? What are the key issues and the key challenges in the last 3 years that you've been with the gay and lesbian rights lobby?
Wow. I think actually lots of the issues and challenges have really been, there's been a lot of internal ones, more in terms of, there were a few sort of key reforms that were won around the federal law reforms sort of in 2008 and looking at getting all of those things done. And so that was sort of, I guess, a big key win that had sort of been going on for a long time. And we did that in conjunction with a number of other lobby groups, state-based lobby groups from around the country. And so that was probably a big win. And obviously the Rainbow Families Council had a lot of a really big win around the assisted reproductive technology and things like that at a state level. And then it was just sort of looking at, all right, well, how do we recover from a lot of that activist burnout and turnover that happens? So really trying to recruit again, a full committee of management, making sure that we had all the right skills sorts of covered, because you don't just want people who are interested in policy and advocacy. You really need people who are interested in fundraising, who can do communications and media and all of those sorts of things. And so a lot of that's been sort of quite internal focused, but looking at how do we make this function really well. So
And what's been your main involvement? What areas have you done most of your work in with them?
Lots of it has been mostly just, I guess, repositioning ourselves once the government had changed at a federal level. Mm. So looking at, okay, well, you know, who are the key players going to be? Where are our key allies going to lie? And because the Committee of Management had a really big turnover, looking at sort of reskilling all of us again and making sure that we all had we're on the same page in terms of contacts, recreating policy for the lobby itself, because after achieving a whole bunch of things, then you've got to say, well, what's our next step and where do we go from here? So, and then talking with the community about that, what's important to them, and then developing those campaigns from there.
What's your opinion of the reforms that have been achieved? Are they fair dinkum?
Oh, look, I think they're fair dinkum, but I also think that, you know, look, in the grand scheme of things, they're pretty lame. what you're looking at is essentially they're saying, oh, yeah, great, now you're the same as everyone else when it comes to, social security or tax or superannuation on most counts and those sorts of things. But the sorts of symbolic things where it really matters, actually, you're not the same and you're not equal and we don't think that. We're not even going to pretend to think that. And I think that's in lots of ways, it's almost more offensive than sort of how it was beforehand, because it's just sort of saying, yeah, we want to take, we want to be able to tax you the same way and all of these sorts of things. We certainly don't want you to have access to any extra benefits. So we're going to get rid of all of those things, but we're absolutely not going to say that you can have the symbolic recognition that, family law is founded upon, which is pretty poor form.
Mm.
So we've still got a long way to go before we're equal.
Yeah, yep. Yeah, and it just seems like we're just waiting for a whole bunch of politicians to catch up with where Australians are at, which is a pretty unusual sort of thing.
Yeah, because the reality is the research says that most Australians don't have a problem,
That's right.
With the notion of gay marriage.
Yep, just don't care. Yep, don't see why it's a problem, don't see why it's an issue. Yep.
Yeah, I wonder why the politicians feel like marriage is so sacred when the majority of the population doesn't. Do you have, having been in that position where you've been with people lobbying politicians and hearing what their advisors or whatever, what is going on with them?
Well, because for a lot of them, that's their personal belief, that's you know, that is honestly what they believe personally, and they're in a position where they can, you know, hold that line and do that in a way where it's defensible, because they can say, oh, there are all of these marginal suburban seats and, you know, lest we lose them, you know, we don't want to even take that risk. So, you know, there's a couple of political things that they can hide behind, but really it's just a good way of being able to say, this is what I believe and I'm in a position to enforce that.
So there are more of them that believe it than those that don't, or are they just in the high powered positions?
I think it's probably it's really difficult to tell. Yeah. To an extent, obviously there are people who are, you know, quite pro equality on all sides of the fence, and that's you know, and they are strong advocates in caucus. But the reality is that if they can't say it publicly, then it's still doing damage, you know, to young people in the community or young people who are out in the suburbs saying, I just want to be able to, you know, be who I am openly.
Mm. Yeah.
Yep, and they can't.
And I suppose if the majority of Australians don't care, I mean that's good in one way, that they don't care, that they're, you know, they're sort of not negative towards it, but that's a lack of care. So, well, the politicians can kind of do what they like, because they're not going to push against it,
are
they?
That's right, yeah. Yeah, and that is hard, and that's one of the reasons why, you know, obviously there's a lot of debate in the community about marriage and marriage equality and all of those sorts of things, and lots of people are like, I don't like marriage, I don't believe in it as an institution, I don't want it. You know, so they say, so I'm not going to be involved, but, you know, marriage is the thin end of the wedge, and when you have marriage, that's, you know, whether you choose to use it or not, and whether you believe in it or not, it is the thing that makes it, I guess, that pulls the pin on really being able to sort of break down all of that other institutionalised homophobia. Mm. So, yeah.
Yes, because ultimately you're either an equal citizen or you're not.
That's right.
Aren't you?
Yes.
If you're full on equal citizen, you should have exactly the same rights as every other
equal
full
or...
on equal yeah. citizen. Is that the biggest challenge that organisations like the VGLRL face, in that not enough people in the community care? So the politicians can go, you can blap on all you like and tell us all these fabulous things, but we don't really have to listen, because nobody really cares enough to vote us out of power because of it.
Yep. Yeah, in a lot of ways, that's the, you know, that can be a big concern. But I think probably what's an even bigger challenge for organisations like the lobby is getting people excited about things that are less tangible than marriage. You know, marriage is, everyone knows what it is, and it's easy to see. But when you talk about things like education reform, people are like, wow, that's boring. But that's really important, because that's where you can really target what's happening to kids at schools and, you know, how teachers talk about relationships so that kids don't feel excluded. So instead of saying, you know, this is a girls' school, so you're all going to have boyfriends one day, they say this is a girls' school, so at some point you're probably all going to be in a relationship. And, you know, but that sort of stuff actually happens at a government level, you know, where you really have to say... teachers need to be trained to use gender neutral, or be aware of, you know, the varieties of people who do exist in the classroom. You know, you're talking about 1 in 10 students. The average classroom size is, what, 26 to 30?
Yeah.
That's a lot of queer kids
at least
in class. Yep, that's right.
How entrenched is that in terms of the system, and how far do we have to go to change it so that kids can go to school and go, yep, whatever?
Yep. Yeah, look, it's amazingly entrenched in the system, and there are a couple of good things that have happened sort of over the last couple of years in terms of, you know, bullying policies and whatever else that have changed. But the thing that we're really noticed, and there's a lot of research around, is that unless you explicitly target homophobic behaviour and actually say this kind of behaviour, i.e. homophobia, is wrong, then people... it doesn't necessarily sink in. So if you're just talking to kids and you say, don't behave in an antisocial way, they don't necessarily go, oh, that means I can't call that kid a fag. Like, they don't make that connection unless you make it for them.
Is it difficult for teachers without the legislative statement being very, very strong and very clear, to even if they want to do that? Is it too hard for teachers?
It can be, because in a lot of senses, you've got to remember there's no protection for teachers who are working in religious schools. There's no anti-discrimination protection. So the last thing they want to do is have themselves outed in some way. And so that's, you know, and there have been some changes at a state level that have given them slightly more protection. But still, you know, if it's your job on the line, how much do you want to do that? And so that's, you know, that's one of the things. And then, obviously, because there is no, I guess it's the homophobic stuff in curriculums is all opt-in. So unless the school itself decides that it wants to opt-in, teachers just can't make those decisions. And, you know, they're still subject to, you know, sort of parent committees who might not want it. And if you're a kid like me who went to a Christian school with a, you know, Christian sort of parents committee and all of those sorts of things, then what hope have you got of ever, you know, being exposed to anything like that or being told that your life might in fact be okay?
Yeah. Mm. So, and you were talking about teachers fearful of being outed and in some cases obviously losing jobs and things like that when you're dealing with certain aspects of the education system. Do we need just all the straight teachers to get up there and do it for us?
Well, I think you need them there with you. Mm. You know, no one wants to be out in a limb alone. Mm. And, you know, look, as someone with a strong union background, that's, you know, that the Australian Education Union's been very strong on this sort of thing. And they're saying, you know, if this kind of thing can affect one of our teachers, it can affect any of them. And that's, and for them, that's the thin end of the wedge, is there has to be anti-discrimination protection for all teachers, regardless of what, you know, the issue might be.
Yep. Yeah. Hayley, you're obviously a woman that gets in there and puts her money where her mouth is.
Something like that.
You know, you've worked in the VGLRL, Union of Students, now you're working with the Greens on their campaign. Why is it important to get involved in what you believe in? Why is it important to you to get involved?
Because that's how you make things better. That's how you make things different. And I think if you've got a problem with the way things are, then not doing something is probably the worst thing that you can do.
Yeah. Do you think too many people sit back and grizzle about it?
I think there's a fair whack of that that goes on. But there's, you know, and I think also organisations like the lobby have to take some responsibility for that and say, well, obviously we haven't made the case enough for people to be involved and we haven't made it easy enough for them. You know, there are lots of reasons why people can't be involved in these sorts of things. And a lot of the time it's about access, you know, if you've got kids or if you live outside of the city or, you know, for any of those things. And that's something that organisations really have to take responsibility for and say, okay, well, how do we make ourselves more accessible so that people can be involved regardless of where they live, regardless of, you know, any accessibility issues they might have, whether that be, you know, mobility, age, children, shift work, all of that sort of stuff. So, yeah, probably a balance of the two.
Yeah. Personally for you, what's been the best thing about being involved with the VGLRL?
I've learnt heaps. I've worked with some really amazing people, and that's, you know, and it's really helped to form my personal politics, like in terms of the things that I believe and think are important. Yeah, that's been fantastic for me. I've gotten a lot of new skills. I work with some great people and I've seen lots of people, you know, become involved in things because of what we've been doing or even just because of people that they've spoken to about what needs to change. And they, you know, have gone from a position of feeling like, what on earth can I do about this thing that's really awful, to saying, yeah, well, this is what we can do and here's how we're going to do it. And isn't that a fantastic thing that, you know, we've got the skills and capacity to actually start making change where it matters for us?
Good on you. Hayley, we're going to have to wrap it up. My last terrible question, piece of advice that you might leave someone. It's great to get some advice from someone who's about a third of my age.
I must look about 12. So that's great.
What?
I think that was a compliment, mate.
Yeah, it was. I slipped it in there.
Thank you so much. You can come anytime.
Thanks.
What would you say to someone who's kind of hanging around going, oh, you know, life isn't so good, or the, you know, there are these things that need doing, or just reflecting on their own life?
I think for me in an election year, the place where I'd start is just, you know, who you vote for matters. Like, that's the bottom line, is, you know, put your money where your mouth is when you go to the ballot box. Learn how preferences work.
Yeah.
Put your money where your mouth is and then get involved, you know, whether it be with a political party or with an organisation like the Lobby or any of those amazing volunteer organisations that exist, you know, Switchboard also, even here at Joy. You know, if there's a thing that you're really excited about then and you want to do something about it, then do it. Send that email. Do it.
Go for it.
Yep.
Hayley Conway, thank you so much for joining us this morning on Saturday Magazine, and good luck with what's going to be a big year for you.
Thanks.
Yeah.
We are going to finish up, Mez, and we're going to play this track for Tex, who's not well.
No, he's too sick to text.
Which must be sick. He must be sick, and he loves a bit of Dusty, so we'll finish up with Dusty. But before we go,
we'd like to thank all of our guests, Karen Strock, Eilisha, did I say that right?
Eilish
Hughes, and Hayley Conway, of course, and a big thanks to our program support and the newsreaders as well.
Yep, and news will be coming up at 12, followed by Detours. stick around Joy all weekend for some fantastic gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, intersex.
This has been another Joy 94.9 podcast. Joy 94.9 is a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station committed to providing a voice for the diverse GLBTI communities. You can support our work by becoming a member or making a donation. For details, go to joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.